And somebody came during a break to mention one of those questions. How many people like those questions online? Online? Okay. You're going to see different, you're going to ask it from a different point of view. You got a clinical story, right? And one of the questions had a diagram of the sequence of events of acute inflammation. So it gave you a little, it gave you an incentive. And that diagram was basically taken from the syllabus, similar to it, and showed you the different components. Those sequences are important to you clinically. It's not just to be memorized for an exam and forgotten. It is critical. Because when a patient comes in, they should come to you not when it's 2 weeks into the inflammatory process. They need to come in as soon as possible, right? Because you want to avoid the consequences of scarring, chronic inflammation, which we're going to talk about, or abscess formation. Then we got our options become less clinically for the patient, and it's not optimal. So it becomes important to think of this process. So acute inflammation is part of the innate. If the acute inflammation fails, whatever the consequence, patient is still picking at their scar, they're still going out and getting injury again and again and again. When you tell them not to do it, well, they're going to go into chronic. It's guaranteed or their money back, okay? So when we talk about chronic inflammation, this is a failure of acute inflammation. That's how you have to think of this clinically. We want to avoid this. But there are some conditions where you start out with chronic inflammation, and you want to avoid it to go further. Otherwise, we've got problems, as we'll see. So when we talk about chronic inflammation, it's a failure of the acute inflammatory process. That's how you have to think of it. Acute is what we want to get in and out, get it done, and move on. If the underlying cause, trauma, an infection like TB, the slow-growing organism, then it's going to go on to chronic, and the consequences are not going to be desirable for the patient, which we'll go through. And so now we're going to initiate the adaptive immune response, and that means making antibodies or making cytotoxic T cells that are coming in and destroying the and damaging the tissue further. When you think of the causes of chronic inflammation, there are going to be causes that are hard to get rid of, like TB or other infectious organisms, like leprosy, okay, or HIV. Doesn't matter. So it's important to realize that if you go into chronic, it means it's a tough situation to get rid of the eliciting process or etiology. Microorganisms, I told, is one example. The other is, and this is why we're going to talk about immunopath, is autoimmune diseases, where you're attacking yourself because you recognize yourself as being foreign. That's what we call autoimmune self. Destroying, you're taking your immune system that looks at yourself and says, you know what, you're abnormal, I'm going after you. I don't need any microorganisms. But you're immunocompromised because if you can't recognize yourself, then other organisms can come in and cause a problem as a consequence. So when we compare acute and contrast clinically to a patient, all the patient has to do is tell their story to you, and you can tell it's acute or chronic. Because what's the time? What is the cell that we talk about acute inflammation? We think of always neutrophils, and what's the and it's prominent color, dolor, tumor, rubor. Okay, very prominent, very distinct and cardinal signs of inflammation. Now when you talk about chronic, it's days, weeks, months, years, decades. As soon as I say, I've had this pain for 10 weeks, acute or chronic? Chronic. As soon as they open their mouth and tell you that, you know you're dealing with a chronic. If they say it's 2 hours, acute. Say, all I have to do is tell you the time. You ask, how long have you had this? Tell you the process. Or they may say, I had this 10 years ago. And it resolved. Now I got it again 2 days ago. It's acute again, but over a period of time. Where it resolved, then it came back again, whatever the cause. Okay? Children, acute inflammation, their ears, ear infection. It resolves with antibiotics, they come back a couple of weeks later, another ear infection is acute, acute, acute. So you have to put it in the context of the history. So when you think of chronic, is macrophages and lymphocytes, because they live longer. They're part of the adaptive immune response. Now, this is the other key. They're cardinal signs that you see clinically are less obvious. Now, why is this important to know clinically? This is a pearl for clinical. You're doing your clinical rotations, or you're going off. I'm starting to get the emails about people being away for these lectures. All you have to do is listen to the patient's history. They say to you, I've been going to the doctors for the last 6 months, and I've gone to 5 doctors. I've been to 4 physical therapists, whatever it may be, and no one tells you what's going on, acute or chronic. As soon as they tell you you've seen more than one physician, it's what? Chronic. As soon as they say that, it tells you the process right before your eyes. The question is, why is it chronic? That's the key. Because if you understand why it's chronic, then you understand what you're going to do next to help that patient. And this becomes very important. Okay? All you have to do is listen to the patient. The patient always tells you the answer, just like an exam. On exams, board exam, whatever, they're 1,000% honest. In the real world, anything goes. Okay? So what they don't say can also give you a clue. It's basically, I don't have nothing wrong with me, and you see them walking in and they're limping. I don't even have that limp. Oh, 5 months. Acute or chronic. See. But they didn't say they had anything wrong, did they? But they did. You just have to watch the patient, and it becomes very obvious what's going on. So chronic inflammation, what are the important cells? The monocytes, macrophages, they're going to interact with lymphocytes. This is the cardinal features, those cells. PMNs only live 1 or 2 days. Macrophages live 60 to 120 days. So they're going to be around for both acute and chronic. If acute fails, they're going to take over and now be going to chronic. You have plasma cells as part of the making antibodies. That's part of the adaptive response as part of chronic. And T cells, a cellular response. Then eosinophils, where you think of parasitic infections, or people who have hay fever or asthma. Those are chronic episodes or damage. They're starting with the chronic inflammatory cells. Fibroblasts. These become definitely activated and more prominent because what do fibroblasts make? Collagen. So what's the likelihood of seeing scarring? Is it more like to see an acute or chronic? Chronic. Because if you have macrophages living 620 days versus neutrophils that live 1 or 2 days, who's going to produce more scarring? An acute or chronic? Chronic. So you just have to think about it when you're exercising. Acute and chronic. Think of, and then just watch people having acute and chronic injury around you. Mast cells around your blood vessels. Endothelial cells are going to be prominent both in acute and chronic inflammation. You're going to get more angiogenesis, more inflammatory response, more collagen production. Here's what chronic inflammation, this is when inflammation is itis. So anything you want to play a word game with yourself or somebody you want to have fun with, just say, give me an organ, tell me what the inflammatory processes. So when you think of appendicitis, you either call it acute or chronic. Right? Itis, meningitis, osteomyelitis, you name it. There's an itis for everything. So pneumonia, we call it pneumonitis, or inflammation of the lung. It can be acute or chronic. Yes?
What about osis, tendinosis?
Tendinosis means osis is a condition of. Versus an itis means you have an inflammatory component. Now you got to decide, is it acute or chronic? There you go. Okay, based on what you see clinically and what the clinical story is with the patient. So when you go on these clinical interludes, you got patients who are inflamed, you should always ask the question is, this is acute or chronic inflammation just by listening to the patient? Then you're going to decide what's going to happen. So if you look at the lung, you notice in the interstitium, the alveolar walls are thickened, and you'll see these chronic inflammatory cells, macrophages and lymphocytes. Will I give you a picture of this like on the exam and you're supposed to identify it? The answer is no. I said in the first day, I'm not here to train you as pathologists, I'm going to train you as clinicians. But you have to understand what cells are going to be there. When I say chronic, what do I think of? Macrophages and lymphocytes. That's what should come right when I say acute. Neutrophils. That's all you got to do. It's that easy. You do all this stuff, and that's all you got to remember. The consequences. Here's a chronically inflamed mucosa of the respiratory tract. Here we see lymphocytes. Here we see plasma cells. Here we see a big macrophage. So this is acute or chronic? chronic. So if I give you a exam question, or I'm going to describe what I see on a biopsy, that description should be able to tell you whether it's what? Or? Right, that's all you got to do. I wish I could go to school again if that was that easy. But it is, okay? But you'll create some other story or choice, okay? Here's what a neutrophil looks like. I showed you this diagram of the acute inflammation. And here are the granules. They live 1 or 2 days. They're very toxic cells. We don't want them in the tissue too long. We got to worry about abscesses, going to chronic, going to scar tissue. Now look at this macrophage. Which one looks more wild? Just look at the cell. I mean, just look at it. Which one looks wild? Macrophage looks angry when it's activated. I mean, you don't want to piss this cell off. All right? If it's chronically activated, it's going to cause a lot of damage to your tissue. And look at it. It's got mitochondria. It's got rough ER. It's the mobile pharmacist of the body. What's the fixed pharmacist of the body? Are your hepatocytes in your liver interacting with what cell? Macrophages, both in acute and chronic. And so if that macrophage is chronically activated, it's chronically activating your hepatocytes, and the likelihood of causing scarring and chronic damage to your tissue just went up a few notches. And so this becomes very important to see. This is a wild cell. And you can see it's highly metabolic. It makes over 150 different molecules. It is, I consider, a mobile pharmacist. We'll talk about macrophages. And they arise from your bone marrow, from the myeloid stem cell that gives rise to your other white blood cells, like eosinophils, neutrophils. And it has a kidney bean-shaped cell that's circulating as a monocyte. You can see it looks like a kidney. And here you see on an electron microscopy transmission, you can see the heterochromatin is more than euchromatin. Euchromatin means it's transcriptionally obviously less active. And this is a quiescent cell at this point. But when it gets into a tissue, what do you notice about the number of organelles and the amount of euchromatin in the nucleus? It goes up. That's what they mean by an activated macrophage that lives now 60 to 120 days in response to whatever is causing it to become activated. The vast majority of all your tissues have macrophages living in them right now. So that's why it's poised and ready. What are places you don't have macrophages? Is in your cartilage, just chondrocytes. But they're on the outside. Don't worry, they'll get there eventually. They're not, obviously, in your bloodstream. They're monocytes. But if you have damage from the outside of those blood vessels, the damage of the blood vessel, macrophages will come in from the outside. Yes?
Is it not in your blood because there's no vasculature?
There's no vascular. That's one reason. That's very good. Another reason is if you think of tendons, like your Achilles tendon or any tendon, it's dense connective tissue. There's some blood vessels, maybe a posse of macrophages, but there are macrophages on the outside to come in when you cause damage to it, tear a ligament or a tendon or a cartilage. They'll come in. Don't worry. They're poised and ready. So macrophages, this is not to have to you memorize, but you see macrophages have different names. It's like you probably have a nickname in your family because you're special. Well, in the human body, if all these cells in the human body, what's the one cell that has the most number of names for it? It's a macrophage. And it depends on where it lives. If it's a macrophage living in your sinusoid, your liver, we call it a Kupffer cell. If it lives in your bone that reabsorbs your bone, it's called what? An osteoclast. It's multinucleated. Pulmonary, you have macrophages living in your alveolar sac. So when you inhale a TB organism, what's the first cell to see it? Is that macrophage ready to eat it? Then you bring it to the immune system. You get a PBD skin test. Now it comes back positive. In the previous years, it's negative. But then what do they do next is a chest X-ray to show that you're not in an active process in response to it. Then you have to decide, do I take INH or anti-tuberculosis medication or not, even though I have a negative chest X-ray? Because you're macrophages. In your spleen, in your lymph nodes, you have macrophages that are antigen-presenting cells. That's what APC, the part of the immune system. Histiocytes are macrophages live in all connective tissue compartments. Then microglia, where do they live? In the brain. They have very unique macrophages in the brain. Then your bone marrow, Langerhans cells. These are macrophages in your skin. because the skin is chronically becoming injured, stressed. And so you have all these macrophages living in all these various tissues. And so we're just one big bowl of macrophages. One of the main common organs that has a lot of macrophages are your liver and spleen. And so this becomes very important, why macrophages will clear out bacteria from your bloodstream. That's why your spleen, one of the important functions of your spleen is to get rid of these microorganisms. So when you're flossing your teeth and you get that bacteremia, don't worry. Your macrophages are having dinner or breakfast in the morning, depending on when you floss, and they'll take out. Okay, so macrophages are very important to us. We don't really, really truly appreciate them. So if I was wearing a shirt around campus, I'd have macrophages all over it. Okay, because it tells you a lot about many conditions. So activated macrophages, they get bigger because the nucleus is going to open up. The cytoplasm, more organelles, mitochondria, rough ER. Because if I'm going to make over 150 different molecules, I got to become energy dependent, and I have to increase size. I move. Macrophages are migratory cells. They will come to the site when they're recruited, when you need more than what you have in the tissue. And once they're in the tissue, and I'll show you examples clinically how this comes to reality. Another important thing is metabolic rate goes up, obviously, so they're very oxygen-dependent cells because they're going to create a lot of molecules. We'll see this. So what are the three effector functions? That's how you have to think of these clinically. In broad strokes, we'll go through each one of these. First, if I were to adopt a child, it would be a macrophage. Why? Anybody who's been a parent knows children are very fussy when it comes to certain foods. A lot of children. But a macrophage is the perfect child to adopt. You give it anything, it'll eat it. Doesn't matter what you give it. It loves to eat. And I'll show you. Second thing it does, it likes to secrete. It's the mobile pharmacist of the human body. It makes polypharmacia. And we'll see this in various clinical settings. The third function, it loves to present antigen to the immune system to respond to it. Microorganisms like TB. You think of bacteria. You think of foreign material. Even our self-antigens, our DNA that's found in our nucleus, can be a foreign antigen. That's why you see it in autoimmune diseases, for example. So let's go through each of these functions. What signals a macrophage to be activated? T cells, T helper cells, secrete a gamma interferon. This is what causes granulomas or chronic inflammation, a form which we'll talk about, localized collection of modified macrophages, like in TB, for example, or leprosy, slow-growing organisms, or parasites, like schistosomiasis you see in the Middle East or North Africa, for example. Then you have, like we talked with acute inflammation, we have tissue injury, you release molecules that can stimulate the macrophages to become activated in the tissue and recruit more macrophages to the tissue in response to the injury. Now, microorganisms, they have unique molecules that can trigger a chronic inflammatory state. Like parasites, we'll bring in eosinophils. When you see eosinophilia, think of allergic reaction, you think of parasitic infections, like schistosomiasis, which is a parasite. So here's a diagram. You can read the text and all this, you can read the text, but then the diagrams are key because what do you notice? Here you have a monocyte traveling your blood all the time. It's going to come into the tissue as a tissue macrophage, poised and ready. Now you're going to bring it in because you release gamma interferon, you see on the right side that T cell. Then you have other molecules, chemical mediators, or endotoxin is made by bacteria, for example, that will now bring in the macrophage, now becomes activated. Now what do you see? Two important effects. It's not the details that lead to this, but what's the one that's going to promote what? In chronic inflammation? Scarring, fibrosis. Because you're going to release chemical mediators that are going to stimulate your fibroblasts to lay down too much collagen that's irreversible. And that becomes a real problem. We'll get the tissue repair. We'll see this. Now, I release a lot more toxic molecules than neutrophils. What's going to happen? I'm going to cause further injury, more destruction to the tissue, because I'm making leukotrienes, I've got free radicals like peroxynitrite from arginine, we talked about that. They'll bring in neutrophils. What do neutrophils contain? They contain lytic enzymes, and they release all this material and cause further damage. So when you get a macrophage angry, in an inflammatory state, like chronic, we've got real problems because it's going to cause further damage, and so morbidity and mortality of the patient goes up as a consequence. And this is what you're trying to avoid. And you can see nitric oxide is being released, and it's going to stimulate all these, we'll talk about these growth factors that stimulate the fibroblasts that lay down more collagen, and you get real problems. So it loves to eat. It will lead ill. What's the cells that gets rid of apoptotic cells that die, pop off pieces? Is the macrophage. It's cannibalism at the cellular level. Debris, splinters, foreign bodies. People like to put in implants. When you put in a breast implant, what cell do you think goes after it? Macrophages. What are they going to lay? What are they going to put around that implant? Is a fibrous capsule. And now what happens is you'll see that. If that response is, they'll get scarring around that capsule, and now it's going to stretch in the woman or man. Men get implants too. Mm-hmm. Not just women. And now what happens is it contracts down. Now it's going to pull the tissue around that implant, and now it's going to cause pain. Now the patient is going to have chronic pain. They got two choices. What do you think the two choices are? You remove it. Be happy with what you have. Because if you put it in there, what do you think? You're going to get that response again? Yeah. Or they have to get on the table and push down on that implant and rupture that capsule. Oh, yeah. There's a consequence to this. Yes. 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 It can, depending upon your genetic makeup. Are you willing to take that chance, though? Uh-huh. But that's why they try to make material that's non-immunologic to cause that response. Okay. So it depends on what the material is. They're broad specific receptors. They're toll receptors on the surface for various organisms. Then you have scavenger receptors for dead cells, tissues, that's looking around for it. They have opsin receptors. When we talk about C3B, looking for microorganisms that are sugar-coated. How many people had cereal this morning? What do you put on your cereal?
Milk.
What else do people put on their cereal in the morning? Any fruit? No one likes fruit? All right, good. What have you done to your cereal? You opsonize it. You're like a macrophage. You opsonize your cereal, tastes good, you eat it. If you didn't opsonize it, you wouldn't eat it. So we call these opsin receptors. This is a fungus among us that's very common in San Joaquin Valley called San Joaquin Valley fever. Anybody from San Joaquin Valley? All right. This is a fungus that likes to live in the Southwest, and it's in the dust. When I see dust in the San Joaquin Valley, which often occurs, those spores in the air, you inhale it, and it gets into your lungs, and your macrophages take care of it most of the time. But those people, in this case, it went to the brain of a patient. It was a diabetic from the San Joaquin Valley. And went to the meninges. And here you see the microorganism, this fungus. It's a spherule, like a sphere. And here are macrophages eating it. Here's another, all these spherules. Here are macrophages. They fuse with one another. And here you see it's broken through the cell wall when it's been a phagolysosome and now digesting the microorganism. But in this case, it caused a chronic meningitis, and it caused damage to the blood vessels, and they led to brain infarcts as a consequence of the vasculopathy due to the inflammatory process. And there is the microorganism, and the black arrow is the multinucleated giant cells. So it likes to eat. It's similar to neutrophils, but it takes its time. It savors what it eats. That's why it's the perfect child to adopt. And it'll ingest any type of material you put in it. So people do body piercing. What cell goes after it? Macrophages. So until you do it, you won't know how angry you get your macrophage. Here is when you have a red blood cell that leaves the intravascular space, like a bruise, what cell do you think eats it? Macrophage. Think of red blood cells as the Krispy Kreme donuts to macrophages. How many people like Krispy Kreme donuts? Okay, you're a macrophage because that's what you like to eat. The one cell that savors red blood cells in any disease process when you have bleeding is the macrophage. It loves red blood cells. Because it breaks it down, and now you have in the alveolar sacs, those brown cells are hemosynclinated macrophages. So now let's say the patient had hemorrhage in their lung, whatever the process is, and they start to cough up sputum. If the patient had an acute process where it damaged the blood vessels in the respiratory tract, your airways or your lung, it'd be bright red blood. But now if they complain that it's brown or rusty in color, it means macrophages have digested the blood, and it tells you it's a bleeding that took place prior. It wasn't acute. So when I cough up rusty sputum, that means it's old red blood cells. Now, another thing, because you are healthcare professionals, you'll be using macrophages to tell if somebody's telling you about abuse or not. The macrophage helps you in abuse cases, elderly or pediatric. Doesn't matter who's being abused. Spousal abuse doesn't matter. So when you have a patient comes to the emergency room, man or woman, child, oh, I don't care what the age, and they have bruises. Now, here's where the history becomes important, how you use the macrophage to help you. Because as mandated reporters of abuse, you're going to use the macrophage to help you. Who's telling the truth? So let's say they come in, and whoever the person is, and the person is reporting it to, or the patient is presenting, I fell down the stairs this afternoon, and they're in the emergency room 2 hours. And you notice the bruises are red, green, and yellow. Are they telling you the truth? Uh-uh, they lied. How do I know? Because if I have a bruise, what's the first color it becomes when you have a bruise? You've all had bruises. Bruises are purple, right? How long does it take a macrophage to eat one red blood cell? 4 hours. But I told you it's only two. So when it breaks down the red blood cells, what does the color of the bruise become? It first becomes green, biliverdin, within the macrophage. Then it becomes yellow, bilirubin. Then when it's faded away, there's no color anymore, except if it's a lot of rusty color, then it'll be brown. So now this patient has lied to you. Then you have to investigate this is an abuse case. Because the colors were what? All three different colors. If it was a fall within 2 hours, it should be only what color? Purple or red. They lied to you. And your macrophage will never lie to you in a patient. Or they said, they came in and all their bruises are green, but they say they fell down 2 days ago. Telling the truth or not telling the truth? You've all had bruises. Does a bruise resolve in two days? No, they lied again. All happened at the same time. So if you see a child or an elderly person have different colored bruises and it doesn't match to the history, you get to report it as possible abuse. Yes?
You're immunocompromised. Same time.
Unless you've impaired those macrophages, same thing. Yes? That's correct. Correct. That's correct. You've caught them. Yeah. You can never lie to a macrophage. They always tell the truth, no matter who they're in. Yes. Skin color, it's melanocytes. It's in the basal layer. They'll have no real change to it. Now, obviously, you're a more darkly pigmented individual. It's harder to see a bruise, isn't it? So now you have to use other things, depending on what's going on. But even when you have a bruise, what's going to happen to that darkly pigmented? If it's really dark, you may see some change, but it'll alter it. And also, does it make sense based on the pattern of injury of what's going on? Okay? What's another thing that macrophages like to eat? Is carbon, air pollution. I don't care if you smoke your underwear, marijuana, cigarettes, cigars, your homework assignments, anything you smoke. You have incomplete combustion, you get carbon. Who's the one cell in your lung that's constantly eating it? Macrophages. You can always tell what people have been doing in life. This is what they've been exposed to. You can't hide from a macrophage. We're always looking for this. This is a pulmonary lymph node. Your lymph nodes will turn black as a function as adults as you're being exposed to air pollution, smoking marijuana, all this. I don't care what you smoke, that it will cause this carbon to accumulate. Your lymph nodes as adults become black. So if you think of China, like Beijing, where they have a problem with air pollution, all their lymph nodes are turning black and causing damage to their lungs and traveling in that area. Tattoos. Tattoos. They are a reflection. Where do you inject the dye? Here's one that says Grateful Dead. What layer of the skin when you get a tattoo, where do you inject it? Epidermis or dermis? Dermis. Who's waiting for it, do you think? Macrophages. and they come in different colors. And now when we look at a tattoo, here's the epidermis, and here is the dermis, and here are macrophages with that red pigment. Now, what happens to a tattoo as a function of time? Fades. Why? Based on what you learned today, why does it fade? Macrophages have one characteristic. They like to move, don't they? They have a migratory tattoo crawling around underneath your skin. Okay? Now the macrophages live 620 days. They die. Who comes in again? Macrophages. They crawl. They die. Another set of macrophages come in. They eat it. They die. They crawl. They die. They crawl. You do that over a period of time. What does your tattoo look like? It looks like this. You can barely see it. Pink Floyd. So therefore, based on this property of macrophages and tattoos, when's the best time in life to get a tattoo? Before you die. In your 80s and 90s. But if you get it now, it'll become a faded memory of the past. So when people, you look at people's tattoos on their bodies, as when you're looking at them as clinicians, you can tell which one are fresh, which are fading into the sunset. As the macrophage eats, crawls, dies, eats, crawls, dies. Macrophages explains what happens to tattoos. So they're migratory. Your tattoo never stays in the same place. It's chronically moving. You just don't feel it. Could you imagine if you could feel a tattoo crawling? Think people would get it? Be interesting. So, phagocytosis. They digest slowly, contain, and they can ingest all sorts of material. As I'm worn out. They can now, if the material is too big, they can fuse with one another and form multi-degree giant cells. We call epitheloid. This is what suture material looks like microscopically. So if you have a non-digestible suture material, who's going to go after it? Macrophages. And that's what it's doing. But what do you notice that's around? This is a multi-degree giant cell. You can see this here. There is the macrophage trying to eat it. And then what's all this pink tissue around it that's stimulating around that suture material is scar. So when you have a cut, people don't care about scars internally, but they do care about scars on their face or in their body, don't they? So by what do they do today clinically instead of using sutures, if it's not required, is use crazy glue. Because all you have to do is bring approximate the edge of the wound where you're not, and now you don't put sutures in it. You don't promote this chronic repeated. That's why you take the sutures out in 7 to 10 days until you get structural support. You're less likely to get scarring now. So that's why they use crazy glue. So if you need to close a wound, you can use crazy glue. But they have glue especially for tissues to close it without producing scars, especially on your face. Everybody's looking at everybody's face. Yes.
So in the red arrow, that's a wall of macrophages?
Yeah, it's one macrophage that's now fused with other macrophages. You can get up to 100 multinucleate giant cells. Nuclei that becomes one big cell that now is able to go after it. Pretty slick, huh? Here's somebody who is food. Here you see plant material. Somebody aspirated their lungs. Here you see a multinucleate. There's the plant material. And then you see a multinucleate giant cell, and then you see acute inflammatory cells around it trying to ingest it or break it down. After phagocytosis, what does it do? It secretes. It's a mobile pharmacist of the body. It makes antimicrobial enzymes like peroxynitrite that we talked about to destroy chemical bonds within the microorganism, like TB, for example. It produces proteases, collagenase and elastase. That's why if they live 620 days, what are they going to do? They're going to cause chronic damage to the tissue as a consequence once they're activated. They produce free radicals. Everybody worries about taking vitamin E. I would make sure I never get my macrophages activated. That's what I would make sure. You can take all the antioxidants you want, but what's the one cell that, despite all that, if you activate, they will produce free radicals yourself and cause tissue damage. So if you wanted to prevent free radical production, don't get the macrophages activated. Real simple. Complement and coagulation polypeptides are being activated by the macrophages. They're made by the hepatocytes. They also secrete chemokines. They attract other inflammatory cells. This is the gatekeeper, this crosstalk. They'll bring in neutrophils if they require it, if there's significant tissue injury or necrosis to the tissue, as well as bring in eosinophils, for example, plasma cells, cytokines, interleukin, IL-1 and IL-6. That's why you get fever, for example, when they become activated. It tells you the macrophages, if you have fever in any condition, it means what cell is activated? Macrophages. That's the first thing you think clinically. And this becomes important because it tells you the inflammatory process. And the inflammation, if you got fever, it could be a abscess in your toe. It could be an ear infection. Or if you have a young child, you can't find anything in the body, and they're like 2 or 3 years old, and they have a fever, look in their mouth. And all you have to do is they start teething. When you think of the teeth erupting through the gums, you're causing tissue damage. And that's how my son, he would come in with acute fevers, and he couldn't find an infection. But it was because his teeth breaking through his gingiva was causing the fever because it was causing tissue injury in a natural process. So you have to think of what's going on in the patient, that tissue is dying, not because it's infected or been damaged, but it's damaged in a natural process. What happens is the macrophage produces the white blood cells. What tells the bone marrow to make more white blood cells is the macrophage. They produce what is called granulocyte monocyte colony stimulating factor that increases neutrophils to come in eosinophils in response. So they control the bone marrow. They're going to control the liver, acute phase reactants. They'll also release IL-12, which is another interleukin that'll bring in lymphocytes and differentiate into different populations, T and B cells, in response to inflammatory conditions. And other mediators like prostaglandins, leukotrienes. Phagocytosis secretion. What is it also? Third function it does? It presents antigens to the immune system because these become critical. And they collaborate with the lymphocytes, the adaptive immune response, both T and B cells. So here's, we have this ecosystem. This is not to memorize, but you see the macrophage, activated macrophage to the right. We have lymphocytes. We have neutrophils to the right here. You can see they're all interacting with one another. This ecosystem is crosstalking with one another. If you have a defect in any of this component's ecosystem, you are immunocompromised. So you think of an AIDS patient. An AIDS patient, the virus goes after two cells that are CD4 positive, lymphocytes, CD4 helper cells, and macrophages. Now we have a problem. Now you can't fight off viruses, you can't fight off fungi, which are opportunistic infections typically seen in AIDS patients. But another important thing in this ecosystem is now you've deranged it where you have an imbalance of cells that don't have regulatory control over one another, and these cytokines are also mitogenic. Now these patients can get malignancies or cancers, like lymphomas, malignancy of lymphocytes, and that's what increases in AIDS patients, for example. This can be applied to other conditions that destroy the immune system, whether you're born with it genetically or you acquire it like in AIDS. So when you have dead tissue, who's the first cell to arrive? Neutrophils. When there's free food, who's the first person to arrive? PT students. What do you have both in common? Phagocytic. That's how you think of this. When there's dead tissue, who's the first to arrive in tissue injury are neutrophils. Then who follows the neutrophils always? They live 60 to 120 days. Macrophages, to clean up, eat the neutrophils, and if they hang around too long, then they lead on to chronic inflammation. Here's an example of acute myocardial infarct, and here you can see the myocardium is dead, so what's the first cell that comes in? Neutrophils. How long do neutrophils live in tissue? Oh, what do you see down here, the length of this bell-shaped curve? 1 to 2 days. Isn't that 24 to 48 hours? The math hasn't changed, I hope. But then how long do macrophages live that you see coming into this dead tissue? How long do they live? 620 days. What do you notice about the length of this bell-shaped curve? There you go. So you see, that sequence will never change in any disease process you come across clinically. So when you go on these clinical interludes, check out your macrophage. They're out there. So now we come to one form of chronic inflammation called granulomas, which you'll always be asked about. And granulomas are basically a localized collection of modified macrophages or epithelioid, oid meaning like an epithelial cell that has a nucleus surrounded by pink cytoplasm. And they're going to have T lymphocytes that help recruit as well as fibroblasts. Now, when I show you a granuloma, you'll see in a diagram that it looks circular in a two-dimensional world. But in a three-dimensional world, it is what structure? A sphere. So a sphere. So when I look at spheres, I think of granulomas. It's trying to wall off. What's a classic organism that produces this? Is TB, is an example. There are other things that can cause granulomas that are infectious as well as non-infectious. So you think of leprosy, syphilis, a venereal disease. When you go on to tertiary syphilis, you've had it for years to decades. Parasitic infections like schistosomiasis or fungal infections can give you granulomas like coccidiomycosis. I showed you the meningitis. Then what are non-infectious? What can give you granulomas? Well, silicosis, sandblasters. They don't wear a mask. You can produce granulomas in the upper lobes of your lung. Beryllium is a heavy metal. You can aerosolize it in the aerospace industry, nuclear reactors. Foreign bodies. Anytime you get a splinter or you put in something in there or you pierce your body with something, anywhere in the body, who's going to go after it? Macrophage. So you form these multinucleated giant cells of granulomas. Or sarcoidosis, a condition of unknown etiology, a chronic systemic. Multiple organs are involved of granulomas of unknown etiology, and it's a diagnosis of exclusion. You got to get rid of all these other causes of granulomas, and it's a condition that's seen in adults. So here's a diagram that's in your textbook as well as in your syllabus, and in your slides you can see you have this antigen presenting cell that's going to produce IL-12, that's going to produce this T lymphocyte H1 cell, it's a subtype, just T helper cell, that makes this gamma interferon. That's the key right here. Remember we talked about this? This gamma interferon recruits the monocytes from your bloodstream, and it produces this nucleus, the cell, with a prominent pink cytoplasm, and they form this sphere or circular structure in a two-dimensional world. They can fuse to form multi-giant cells. So a granuloma is defined as a localized collection of modified macrophages with lymphocytes and fibroblasts. Is it acute or chronic? Chronic, because you don't see what inflammatory cells. That would have to be acute. Neutrophils, see? That's all it is. Real simple definitions. What's the life and times of a granuloma? You won't find this in any textbook, because somebody, they just figured, just learn a granuloma, memorize it, and walk away, and that's it. But granulomas are in a patient, like any process, has a story. So a granuloma is first going to form a localized sphere. Then, because it gets larger and larger, it has lack of blood supply because there's no angiogenesis, it gets necrosis. Remember, what type of food does it remind you? It's cheese, caseous. So when I think of case necrosis, I think of granulomas inflammation. Well, any necrotic tissue is going to cause an inflammatory response. That black represents the necrosis. And then that pale area, you see, is you replace the necrotic tissue with what? Scar tissue. Then what is all scar tissue? It becomes, contracts down, you get a fibrous granuloma, and because it degenerates, it becomes calcified. We call that dystrophic calcification. Why is this important to understand? When you have a disease process, like TB in the lung, and they've had old TB, what you'll see on a chest x-ray are these little white nodules. And what those white nodules represent, because you've increased the density of the lung, because you have now scar tissue plus it's calcified, that's why they can tell you it's old TB or some other infectious disease. If you come from the San Joaquin Valley, it could be coccidiomycosis. So when you see calcified nodules in the lung, you have to think of them as being granulomatous inflammation, as an example. Okay? And this is the life and times. What's the lifespan? 50 days. Okay? Here's a non-caseating, you see these small granulomas. This happens to be sarcoidosis, multinucleated giant cell. So if we were to outline it in purple, well, we don't want purple, we want blue. Let's see, that's better. There's one granuloma, here's another granuloma, another granuloma, another granuloma, another granuloma. Okay? Two-dimensional world, they're oval or circle. In a three-dimensional world, they are spheres. Right. There it is. Now, this is kind of yellow cheese that likes the macrophages like to travel to the lymph nodes, so you get caseous necrosis. Here you see a granuloma. What's its overall shape? You notice on the outside. Here you see the viable part. And then here's the case of necrosis in the center. Am I going to show you a granuloma? You got to recognize it? No. Will I describe it on the biopsy? Yes. So the definition is what I want you to remember, because it becomes important, because you're going to get access to clinical data from patients. They're going to have biopsy reports. And so you want to read the description of the biopsy and say, does this make sense, what they're calling it? Does this fit what the patient's going on? Or is this another process that I have to think of something else besides what the patient's coming in, they discovered incidentally? So it's not that you have to become a pathologist, but when you read clinical data, you want to be able to feel comfortable interpreting it and thinking about it, rather than just another path report, let somebody else deal with it. Okay? There's necrosis, there's the multigrade giant cells. So clinical correlation, as we finish our chronic inflammation, we have macrophages and lymphocytes that collaborate. The macrophages slowly get into tissue. That's why it's going to be over weeks, months, years, decades. When we see macrophages and lymphocytes, what type of inflammation do we think of? Acute or chronic? Chronic. It equals that. Period. That's the key. When you have fever and night sweats, if you have fever, what cell has been activated? What have we been talking about? Macrophages. She's just automatic. Everybody's copying down on their thing. Blah, 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 blah. Then you ask a basic question. What cell have we been talking about? Okay. So it releases IL-1 and tumor necrosis factor. The number of monocytes, when you do a chronic disease, remember in acute inflammation, what happens to your neutrophils, because they're short-lived, go up when you have acute inflammatory process. But when you have a chronic inflammatory process, the monocytes, if you look at their level in somebody's chronic inflammation, they don't go up very high. Why? Because how long do macrophages live in tissue? 60 to 20 days. So you don't need a large population, and that fluctuation is not going to be as critical interpretation as PMNs that have a short half-life of only 10 hours, and they live 1 or 2 days in tissue, and when they go up, they got to go up big time to compensate for that short lifespan. So this time is a very important variable to you as clinicians in a disease process, what the patient tells you, and how it unfolds, and what you need to do. So, in summary, we've talked about inflammation. We talked about acute. You notice what color is the color of pus? Yeah, there's a color-coded. So it tells you bacteria, tissue necrosis, any type of injury to tissue, whatever it is, you get inflammation. Then you think of chronic, non-granuloma, viruses, lymphocytes coming in, acquired immune deficiency. Then we have granulomas, TB, or foreign bodies or other things that don't produce caseation or cottage cheese, but are just granulomas like foreign bodies. We'll see it as a consequence. Which is worse to have, acute or chronic? Chronic. Why? Why is it more likely to see scarring in a chronic versus acute? I know it's irreversible. Why is it scarring more likely in a chronic than acute? With the collagen, but what cell has been activated in chronic that's stimulating the fibroblast that laid down the collagen? And how long do they live in tissue? So versus a neutrophil that lives 1 or 2 days, which one is more likely to give you scarring, acute or chronic? Chronic, that's the key. What's the variable you should always use clinically? The variable of time. What's the first question you ask of a patient? How old are you? Because each disease is based on how old you are, what you're gonna see. Then you say, how long have you had it? They said a couple hours. What do you call it? Acute or chronic? Uh-huh. But if I had this for 3 months? Oh, see how easy that is? That's all you got to do is a few questions. That's why when you news news reports like Clinton, remember, everybody got all excited about her pneumonia. How do I know it was acute or chronic? How many was it days or weeks she had it? She was diagnosed on Friday, and it came available, the results, on Sunday. Acute or chronic? 2 days. What is acute or chronic? A acute. That's, you just have to listen to the history and you can make the diagnosis just by listening to her neutrophils or her macrophages. All you have to do is listen to the patient. The patient loves to tell you the story. Okay? On that note, have a non-inflammatory day. This podcast was recorded by Dr. Henry Sanchez at the University of California, San Francisco.